and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz from the technician's chair.
Well, that's where you always sit.
That's where I always am, yeah. It's always a bit of a rerun, but one day I'll come up with the ultimate pithy comment.
Well, it's been two years. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to cfru.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Podcast channel, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today, just in time for Christmas, we are going to talk about our favorite political documentaries. It's a thematic sequel, let's call it, to last year's Christmas show about favorite political movies, where we intentionally left off documentaries, because, I mean, it's kind of so easy just to, you know, talk about political movies.
We could have a whole show just based on those.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know about you, Scotty, but I've been sort of taking comfort in pop culture lately, you know, just watching some positive, uplifting fare that's, like, still politically related. So, like, things like The West Wing and Parks and Rec and, like, Zemeckis movies like Contact, and there's, like, 13 Days, which was about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, when you had smart people dealing with difficult problems. And, of course, it's Christmas time, so you have, like, It's a Wonderful Life and... A Christmas Carol about, you know...
Yeah, Wonderful Life is actually quite a political movie when you dig down a bit.
Oh,
I
sure.
mean, considering the times it was made. And there's a lot of savvy political television right now. I've been watching, or just started to watch, The Americans, which is it's good so far. I'm one episode in and I'm already hooked. So that's usually what happens, right? They get the hooks in. And if there's lots of others on the agenda that I haven't gotten around to yet because... If I did that, all I did would be watch Netflix and
yes,
other sources.
Yeah, no, and I'm in the same boat with you in terms of just, you know, it seems to be the pop culture bounty, the modern bounty, where there's so much to watch. And, of course, it's moved to... This kind of gets us getting off topic, but it's moved to TV now. And, of course, you know, the average TV show is like 13 episodes, and so that's like 13 hours of... stuff to watch, and everybody has lives too. And you know, the way I cope with it is just like you can't feel bad that you're not watching something. You kind of just like, if you can get around to it, great. If you can't, there's lots of other stuff to watch. And
if you pull a Siggy, you can binge, right? You can just sort of put the duvet on and sit, and it's like, I'm going to spend the 13 hours watching this.
So, it is.
Don't tell your boss. That I said that.
Yeah, okay.
Hertz said you can do what you like. No, you can't.
Hertz said I can watch
Wink.
Netflix at work. It's,
Wink.
It's fine.
Yeah.
He gave me permission.
Exactly.
I listen to
CFRU. You're testing the connection. That's what you're doing, right? That's really what you're doing.
Well, let's test the connection to our political documentary picks. You won the coin toss, Scotty, so you can pick first.
So the movie I chose is actually from last year, from 2015, and it's called Suffragette. Came out early in 2015. It's, as the name suggests, it's a fictionalized account of the suffragette movement in the UK in the early 20th century. There are a lot of appearances by real characters. It's one of those films that's sort of based on real events, I guess you'd say, because there's a lot in it that actually happened. But, of course, to tell the story, which went over a period of years, a lot of years actually, it was necessary to kind of hybridize certain characters. The stars include Carey Mulligan, who is in Llewyn Davis. You'd recognize Carey Mulligan if you don't know the name.
She was in An Education, too.
An Education?
She was also in the Blink episode of Doctor
I should have just asked you because you're like automatically know. So, you know that Carey Mulligan kid? Anyway, she's very good. Helena Bonham Carter plays another kind of a hybridized character. And there's a cameo by Meryl Streep, who plays Emmeline Pankhurst, one of the real characters who was one of the strongest advocates. She's a bit of, I would call her a bit of a society woman, I guess you say. One of the things that's interesting about that fight was that it does transcend the classes, where there were a lot of women at the top, let's say, upper middle class perhaps, and also at the very bottom who kind of united in this fight. So she was the leader, I guess, if you will. So Her life, I think, could probably have a standalone film, and I think that it's probably been rendered into a, I think it was rendered into a made-for-TV movie. So in terms of the historical timeline, it was early 1912, 1913 when the suffragettes went into action, I guess. It started progressively to that point, but that was the point where they went kind of militant. I think today they would probably be considered terrorists in the nomenclature of today because they went from smashing windows, which is a fairly common tactic, to blowing up post boxes. Letter boxes, but yes. And I think there were two events that were the peak of activity. One was they planted a bomb at the empty house of Lloyd George, who was the prime minister at the time. Thankfully, it was empty. I don't think anybody was killed in there. That was intentional. Their militant activities were to draw attention rather than to actually harm anybody, I believe, anyway. But somebody that was harmed was Emily Davidson, who was a suffragette who was trying, they believe she's trying to make some kind of statement in the middle of the famous horse race at Epsom Downs, Epsom Derby, which they still have every year. And she was killed by it was the king's horse. King had a horse in the race. Queen currently has horses in races, same kind of thing. And you've probably seen her face. She's very happy when they win. however, so Emily Davidson was killed outright. And that was possibly the turning point that raised the awareness of the suffragette movement, great outpouring of grief on that. There was a bit of an interruption, which they sort of gloss over in the movie, by World War I. Pankhurst, among others, sort of embraced the war cause and I wouldn't say suspended completely, because there were suffragettes that kept doing what they were doing, but the sort of mass movement was put aside a bit until the laws changed after the war, first with the Persons Act, I guess. The Persons Act was a Canadian one. I think it was called the Representation of People Act, where women actually were given the right to vote if they fulfilled the property requirements, which still to this day seems kind of like, oh, okay, you can vote if you have property. That included some men too, actually. So there were some men at that time that benefited. And I think it took another 10 years until everybody over 21 was able to vote in the UK. So very interesting story. Not a perfect film. I would say there was points where it kind of lagged a bit in terms of, you know, just there was that thing missing when they did. I don't know if it's because they did the kind of hybridized, stylized, whatever. They did a really good job at presenting it. Possibly a bit preachy at times, I guess. But considering the topic, it's not surprising. But a fairly good effort by the filmmakers whose names escape me, but it's a good one. So Suffragette is on my list.
That's interesting, because I do wonder how deeply the story's been told. I think probably the closest anyone's come to seeing like the suffragette movement on TV or in the movies recently is like the old like Heritage Moments.
I think that's why I automatically said the Persons Case, because that's the Canadian version. And I think it was due to the laws in the UK changing that was able to change here, because we were still subject to Westminster until 1931, I guess it was. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, you're right about that. And it sort of makes an appearance occasionally. I want to say pop culture, but they do talk about the suffragette movement in Downton Abbey. It comes up. The youngest daughter is a bit of a radical in that department, like wearing pants. Ooh, wearing pants. So it's a bit of a cheesy kind of referencing of the movement. But yeah, in terms of getting a sort of broad historical view on it, suffragette does do a good idea. And it's actually something, it's a bit untapped too, that I guess there's lots of potential there to tell the, you know, the rest of the story, like I said, about Pankhurst and others. So we'll see.
Well, interestingly, it turns out it was a woman who wrote it and a woman who directed it. And then the director is Sarah Gavron, who you probably don't remember or probably haven't heard too much of what she's done. I think probably her most notable thing is a movie, Brick Lane, that I recognize the title of, but I don't think I've saw it. Yeah, it stars some Indian actors. I think she herself, Sarah Gavron, is of Indian heritage as well.
Yeah, I think this might be her first large effort, let's say, in like a wider release movie.
Yeah.
And this happens a lot with directors, you know, kind of toil away at certain things, TV sometimes, and then they end up doing something something larger with Meryl Streep in it, among other stuff.
Well, you know, it doesn't hurt your street cred to have Meryl Streep in there. And, yeah, I think it's a timely movie. I think it came out but last year or so, you know, is kind of maybe presaging Hillary Clinton's then assumed arrival in the presidency, presaging unintentionally Theresa May's ascension to the prime ministership in Great Britain, or in the UK, I should say. Although, you know, would have guessed that this time last year, Theresa May would now be Prime Minister of Great Britain. And yeah, like I said, it's an important story because I don't think it's a story that we're sort of vaguely aware of the great characters of the civil rights movement. So, you know, your Malcolm X's, your Martin Luther King's, but I don't think we're even vaguely aware of the characters of the suffragette movement. In Canada, U.S., or U.K., it's kind of taken for granted, I think. So even a dramatic retelling in the form of a docudrama.
That's right, because I don't think people realize that it was that long ago. I mean, it's not even 100 years yet, and that seems like, well, it's obviously a lifetime. I suppose there are still people alive that were around, not very many, and I remember those days, but it was a long haul, a long struggle. I think it continues to this day, too. I mean, as we've seen with the election in the U.S. and that there still seems to be, and not seems to be, that there is this double standard with women, not just in politics, but across the spectrum, and in terms of equal pay and true equality, I think is still a struggle that's going on today, rather than just getting the vote, which we take for granted now. Everybody takes for granted that you are able to vote.
Yeah.
And a lot of people take it for granted so much so that they just don't bother, male, female, whatever. So it took quite the struggle to get to that point, and I think the struggle continues in certain ways, and that remain to be seen.
The struggle is key, and Selma, I think the first scene in Selma is Oprah Winfrey's character trying to register to vote and just like how hard it is, or how hard it was, probably still hard it is in some places in the United States, especially if you're black, to register to vote. And you know, from our point of view, it's ridiculous the roadblocks are thrown up in front of her. But I mean, this was real and not too long ago, and I think, yeah, the difference between the civil rights, remembering civil rights, is that there are still people who remember the civil rights struggle, and it's very different for the suffragette movement, because there is no one alive who remembers fighting that fight. So it's all history.
Yep, and I will say within the movie, too, there's a point where it kind of deviates into a police story. The Brendan Gleeson, who you will definitely recognize, has been in a billion things.
Mad-Eye Moody.
Plays the Irish cop. It's a bit of a cliche, I guess, but there's this investigation, like, I'm going to find the suffragette that did this, which is a little bit of a deviation, but he's very good, so it sort of works, because I guess, you know, they are on the hunt for the people that are planting these bombs and throwing rocks through windows and whatnot, to which they successful somewhat in finding them, and a lot of the suffragettes, I think there was at least 1,000 of them jailed over the period of time, and subject to force feeding and unspeakable things, because they went on hunger strikes for the rights as political prisoners. Mm-hmm. A lot of them weren't treated as political prisoners. They were treated as felons, let's say, and I guess that's a whole story in itself, but yeah, just despicable treatment in prison for them. So it's one of those lest we forget kind of things.
Mm-hmm. he does seem kind of forgotten, but my choice for my first political documentary is Mitt, which is the Netflix documentary. Well, Netflix didn't make it. They bought the rights, and you can find it on Netflix. But it is about one Mitt Romney, who ran for president in 2012, was a Secretary of State candidate for the upcoming Trump administration, didn't quite seal the deal for various reasons, some of which may be believable or not. But this follows, it's this kind of split in two. the first half kind of follows him as he's running in 08, and you may remember he was a candidate in the Republican primary in 08. That was the year John McCain became the nominee. That was also Barack Obama's first presidential election. So the forces of history were not in Mitt Romney's favor. But it follows his family. The first scene is his family having a meeting about, the pros and cons of him running, and it follows through as he's trying to, first of all, he's trying to establish himself, because Mitt Romney was not a well-known name in the first time he ran in 08. And so he's struggling against that. He's struggling against the inevitability, seemingly, of John McCain. A lot of people, I guess, choosing John McCain because, the idea that everybody gets a turn is something that he was struggling against. It was John McCain's turn after being the runner-up to George W. Bush in 2000. So, and then Mitt Romney, oddly enough, it was then his turn in 2012. And then after he sort of concedes the 2008 primary, the movie jumps ahead to the 2012 presidential election and picks up that campaign at the Republican National Convention in 2012 and follows him through the debates, the presidential debates, including the first one, which he had a better than expected performance. And it shows behind the scenes, like his reaction to that better than expected performance and then the follow-up debate, which was of course famous for that moment where he was trying to make a point that Barack Obama hadn't called the Benghazi embassy attack terrorism, and then Candy Crowley confirmed that the Barack Obama did call it terrorism the day after. In the minds of some people coming out on the side of Obama, and then the reaction backstage to that, and then all the way up to election night, and there was, of course, the story that they hadn't written a concession speech, and everyone thought that, that was kind of hooey, that, it kind of painted a picture of, I guess, maybe the sloppiness of either the campaign or the expectations that, they just believed that all the polls were telling them the opposite of what was true. But it did in fact turn out that it hadn't written a concession speech, because it shows them writing the concession speech at like 10 o'clock.
The emergency
concession, that's right. I think I chose this because, Mitt Romney's been in the news a lot lately. Mitt Romney's also the subject of, I think, he's one of those politicians who people sort of pile on and paint with whatever colors they need to paint him with. And there's a lot of talk in the movie about him being the Mormon flip-flopper, which is kind of a neat three-word summation of what his what he appeared to be. But I think what I find interesting about the film is, and this goes into the story behind the film too, is that the Romneys allowed the filmmakers this access with the acknowledgement that this film would not be released before the election, which I think in retrospect is a mistake, because this film does a lot to humanize especially Mitt Romney in terms of not being the Mormon flip-flopper, not being like the Ken doll presidential candidate. You see him more laid back. You see him like in moments where he's, acknowledging his own weaknesses, where he's acknowledging the strength of his opponents, where he's, being reasonable in debate. He is that. He is like the movie poster president. The way, the movie in the 1960s would paint the president of the United States. But I do think he has lent more humanity watching this 90-minute behind-the-scenes documentary than anything, any of the press or any of the outreach or any of the interviews he did, excuse me, in the 2016 campaign or 2012 campaign or the 08 campaign for that matter.
He's a very interesting character, and that's, of course, they make for great documentaries. And Romney, I think, in a lot of ways, is a bit maligned A lot of it to do with, as you say, the Mormon aspect. I think there was a sense that there's a lot of people reluctant to support him specifically because of that. Part of that, I guess, is not really understanding Mormonism, but to me, it reminded me of back when they would talk about, oh, Kennedy will never be elected because he's a Catholic.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, even though he's a Republican, there's some similarities with Romney, I think, and Kennedy in terms of that presentation, at least, in terms of being like, as you say, the when you think of president, you know, like the movie version or the guy that shows up in the film, you know, you picture a face like Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Whether he would make the great president or not, of course, either remains to be seen or we don't know. But it's not that he wasn't lacking experience at all, unlike, well, let's say, Donald Trump, maybe.
Right.
So, and of course, his name came back to the fore recently when it was like, oh my God, what can we do? Trump's going to be president. Romney's name was floated as in, oh, well, if we're looking for a sub,
yeah,
and if we're able to do it, could we get Romney to do the job? So he's definitely on, I think, we'll call it the Republican shortlist, but I think there's probably a lot of Democrats that probably wouldn't have minded if Romney had become president as opposed to Trump, say, or and of course Clinton. But
that's the thing too. And Bill Maher addressed this on after Trump's election, was like, the Mitt Romney and to a certain extent McCain were painted as like these kind of boogeymen on the right that we can't, like, everything will fall apart if they are elected. And now we have Donald Trump, who seems very likely everything's going to fall apart once he takes office. I mean, it might not. I mean, he might be hyperbolic. But, I mean, in terms of danger and in terms of politicians not understanding the institutions they have been elected to oversee, I think a lot of people recognize that Mitt Romney, you may disagree with him on a number of issues, but he's not so bad. He at the very least has an understanding of the institutions he was running to oversee and represent. And I think at the end of the day, a Mitt Romney presidency would probably look fairly bland. It would probably look like a George H.W. Bush presidency in terms of domestic and foreign policy. I don't think he would have been a George W. Bush figure. He certainly wouldn't have been a Donald Trump figure. It would have been a very bland, manila, middle of the road, policy centric,
like Eisenhower, maybe, or that kind
sure,
of.
Sure. Like, yeah.
I'm doing this thing.
Yeah, and one of the great things about the documentary, it doesn't make a big deal about the Mormon thing. I mean, there are showing moments where the family prays and, you know, they have a post-debate prayer. And I mean,
that's almost a requirement for a president, right? That you have to have some kind of religiosity around you.
I wish it
Trump
wasn't.
Trump may
but,
be
yeah.
the exception,
yeah.
I think.
Although, 2 Corinthians, that's the whole ballgame.
Yeah.
That's kind of the weird part about the Trump phenomenon, is that you go from super piety. I mean, even if you don't get Mormonism, and then there are a lot of evangelical Christians who, as you said, cast a weary eye to Catholicism. It's not real Christianity. So they feel the same way about Mormonism, if not more so.
But they're okay with Trumpism.
But, well, that's a kind of weird aspect of all this is that, you know, the piety, the supposed piety of the Republican Party has gone out the window in favor of, you know, grandiosity that Trump brings. But I do like Mitt Romney as the subject of this film. I don't know if I would like him as a president. I think I would like him better than Trump. But I do.
That's not hard, is it?
But, you know, there's one scene where he's talking about, you know, oh, brother, where art thou? And anyone who likes the Coen brothers can't be all bad in my book.
Oh, so he likes that film, eh?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So I see what you mean about it, revealing the normal side. And I mean, a lot of, including the documentary we're going to talk about in a little bit, that there is this kind of rights thing as to where people will say, well, I really don't want this getting out there. Maybe that's going to turn. Maybe that's going to change and say, you know, you make this fly-on-the-wall documentary and then it helps your bottom line rather than hinders it. Because,
yeah.
And I guess a lot of that is to do with the presentation of it, too, as to what, you know, the biases are, say, of the people that are making it. And, you know, friend or foe kind of thing. I guess you don't let anybody deeply into the fold unless they're going to be somewhat positive. But if you say, okay, this is a warts and all.
Well, that's what's weird. I do believe that the director had some kind of relationship with the Romney family beforehand. And I would have to look it up to see, but I just assume there is because, you know, Josh Romney, who's kind of like the one Romney son is kind of most featured, other than Mitt himself. But, you know, there's one moment where he says, like, it's almost better we don't win because of, like, the interruption to their lives, which, again, is an interesting antidote to the Trump phenomenon where we see that the first kids are
embedded.
Very heavily embedded is a great word. Yeah. So we're going to take a break here for our usual music and PSAs, and then we're going to come back with our next two picks. And as always, you are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Now I'm all grown and I see it was a seven who got that magic charm. Mama, now I know you are the one. There ain't no chimney.
And that was Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings from their album It's a Holiday Soul Party, a favorite here on Open Sources. And that song was Ain't No Chimneys in the Project. So you're listening to a pre-recorded version of Open Sources Guelph this week.
And we are going to continue on with our movie show. We are putting the emphasis this year on documentaries, although somebody for his first pick chose a docudrama. But, I mean, as I always say, it's not a real list unless you cheat. So,
I chose TV last year, and that was like, I got a pardon for that as well. So,
you're just using up your presidential pardons, man.
Yes.
Anyway, your second pick.
My second pick, it's kind of similar to Mitt. This is a fly-on-the-wall documentary from this year. It was just released a couple of months ago. And that would be Wiener, the saga of Anthony Wiener. And, of course, we've spoken about him on the show quite a bit.
Who is that?
Who is Anthony Wiener? If you have no idea who Anthony Wiener is, I will give you the rundown. Anthony Wiener was a congressman from New York, popular, long-running. He was elected as a very young man. He was on, council, I guess, in New York, and then graduated up to being a senator. From, I guess, 1999 to about 2011, I think, until he ran for... And he's also run several times for mayor of New York, but this campaign in particular was focusing on 2013. This movie was focusing on the 2013 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so the synopsis is Wiener's running for mayor, and it's post the first tweeting scandal. So that's how you'll know Anthony Wiener. Obviously, he was famous, almost infamous, for tweeting pictures, suggestive pictures, let's say, of his wiener, which led to countless New York Post headlines about Wiener's wiener, which is also talked about in the movie. So at this point, he's kind of found redemption with the public and his partner, his wife, Huma Abedin, Huma Abedin.
Yeah.
Huma Abedin, who is a Democratic insider as well. Wiener's a Democrat. And Huma Abedin is considered, or was, I think she still is considered as like the daughter that Hillary never had.
Yeah.
She's very involved in the Hillary Clinton campaigns for many, many years. I think she started as probably at least 20, as a young woman being involved with the Democrats and being right in there. She's an insider as well. In this campaign, she's sort of taking a step back. She's still very much playing the first wife, let's say, but she's involved with the campaign, but she's not coordinating it. She does do a bit of fundraising and whatnot. And it's interesting to see. So what happens is in the middle of the campaign, I have to reveal this, even though I'm trying not to reveal too much. Spoiler alert. In the middle of the campaign, it all blows up again. And it turns out that Wiener is still sexting and texting and tweeting people suggestive photos and having... I don't know what you'd call it. I was going to say Twitter sex, but virtual online relationships with several people, one of whom does make an appearance in the movie. Her name is Sydney Leathers. And a good chunk of the drama, again, I may be giving too much away, is the...
I don't think it's a spoiler. If
no,
it's
I guess
news.
I guess not. Is the appearance of Sydney Leathers during the campaign when it's all starting to fall apart. And that's where really it gets interesting to me. Wiener in itself, he is the story, but I like kind of seeing the bits, and there aren't enough of them, I think, in this film, of the kind of secondary stuff that's going on, what the handlers are doing, what the communications person is doing. Mm. His campaign manager actually stepped down in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they don't talk about that too much. You just sort of, it's like, oh, okay, I'm done. Kind of happens very much in the middle of everything going south. I really, really felt sorry for his communications person because you could tell she was stressed. To watch Huma Abedin's face when there was a famous press conference that you can find online. It's also part of it is in the movie where she is kind of going to bat for her husband, knowing full well that you know this is round two. And of course, as we know historically, round three happened this year right in the middle of the presidential campaign.
Yes.
Where she finally said, I guess it's three strikes, you're out in Wiener's case as well, where she finally did leave him. And it also had a direct effect on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign because Wiener's computer was taken as evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as we know, some of the emails that were presumed to have been lost from Hillary Clinton were on... allegedly on Wiener's laptop. So
they were sharing a computer,
so
him and Huma.
That's the last we've heard of him. He's become some kind of private sector consultant by the sounds of it. He's not really involved. I mean, I'm sure he is involved to some degree in politics, but not overtly anymore. And I guess since August with his wife leaving him, it was mainly over. It was a picture. He was texting his parts, let's say, and there was his son happened to be in the frame of the picture, which really, really disgusted a lot of people. So, you know, rather than kind of find redemption from the first round of this, and he was well on his way. He was doing quite well in the election.
Yeah.
He was top of the polls at one point, but as we know, polls are poll schmoles, right? but you also get to see, interestingly, behind the scenes, too, is the whole... Wiener was known as a bit of a firecracker, let's say, and could very easily get riled up. And it becomes clear throughout parts of the film that he's not really able to control that very well, and that this is where he loses ground, not only blowing the whole redemption thing, but the fact that he can't seem to control himself, not only in what he does on social media, but from what he says, too. And there's some really... uncomfortable altercations, not physical, obviously. One of them does almost get physical, but I think I've revealed too much of the movie. But again, it's always interesting to see. And as with Mitt, I think that the person that made this film was also one of Wiener's inner circle, and I think that's why he was able to get the access that he was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are times, and I'm sure it happens in Mitt too, where the camera is kind of sent out of the room. And there was a bit of a postscript too, in that they were saying that Abedin didn't agree to be in the documentary, and there was some humming and hawing about that, but it's too late now. It's out there. It was on CBC. I watched it on, I think it was iTunes Movies. I'm not sure if it's on Netflix, but it is around. It's out there and in fairly wide release, so you should be able to find it.
It's not on Netflix yet.
It's not Netflix yet. Okay.
I can't imagine it wouldn't show up on Netflix at some point, because that's kind of their bag. The thing I find interesting about Anthony Wiener is... He's brash. He's a little crude. He's unapologetically progressive, and I think in the Trump era, he was probably just the right kind of Democratic politician who could form the next movement. I mean, he has Bernie street cred, but he can do it in the Trump way. He blew it, and he blew it three times. What I also find interesting is that there's no kind of this is all digital, digital adultery. It's like virtual adultery. There's mm-hmm. no actual. And the thing that got him into trouble the last strike earlier this year was the sexting with the underage girl via Twitter, and that was where that picture came from. That's why that got so much attention, because it turned out the person on the other end of that exchange was underage.
15, I believe.
So. I almost feel like what makes this worse, I mean, yeah, the underage thing makes it bad, but even if that young lady was like 18, 19, 20 or something like that, I think that what makes this worse in terms of the appearance of a lot of people is the fact it was all digital, because there have been a lot of politicians who have managed to surf sex scandals, but that involved actual sex. I think what makes it dirtier on another level is the fact that all this was going out. You know, it's like seeing and hearing. You could hear about Bill Clinton having an affair with Monica Lewinsky, but here you can actually see Anthony Weiner sending out these pictures to other people, and that kind of grosses it up in a way. And it's a shame too, because he's a very promising politician. He could have easily won, I think, the mayorship.
Oh, he was
of New York.
Extremely well liked, and part of that was his willingness to take people on. The film starts off with him just howling in Congress. I guess it was to do with the a bill regarding the 9/11 survivors and recognition of that. And he's I wouldn't say losing it, but he's being very strong and aggressive. And there is an element of the American and I guess Canadian electorate too that like that, somebody who's going to like take a stand like Bernie Sanders does.
Yeah.
He's kind of unrepentant in what he does in terms of going to the mat for people, and that's what people love. And also, it's serious but quite funny at the same time how Weiner is pandering to the different groups. In particular, he's in the Pride Parade. He's in they show this montage of parades that he's in, and he's rolling with it. I mean, he's loving being I guess the attention that you get from being in a float in a parade, but also, I mean, the crowd are loving him. I mean, and some of that too, I think, took place when all of it was going south the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he still had supporters, you know, also the detractors as well, who have a go at him. But he, you know, you can tell that he's a bit of a media hound, I guess, in terms of, you know, sort of liking being in the spotlight. And I guess that extends to his dalliances, let's say, in social media, which took a turn for the gross. I mean, really, he went on and on about therapy and my wife and I and all those things, because people do also like a story of repentance. They really do. Like,
sure.
If it's the comeback kid, you name it. I don't Well, Trump is the exception. We'll leave him out of it for now. But anybody from Martha Stewart on has done time.
Right.
Johnny Cash, you name it. People who sort of have gone very, very low to those places. And then they come back. And that, I wouldn't say it's the ultimate American story, but it's a very common theme in that they're willing to with time. Oh, Bill Clinton's another example, too. I mean, that kind of stuff, if it had taken place in the internet age, may have sunk him.
Yeah,
like it did Weiner. But then, of course, we have the examples of Trump saying ridiculous things that were caught on tape, and yet he's now president-elect of the U.S. So it's hard. I think a lot of it's to do with the timing too, as to when it happens. You know, that explodes in the middle of a campaign.
Yeah,
your detractors and your opponents are just—I mean, that's all they do during the film is like, "Well, this guy, you can't trust this guy because he's tweeting his penis everywhere." You know, like
the Trump. You can't use Trump as an example for everything. He sort of breaks all exceptions.
Yes.
But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that a lot of people, even his supporters, don't take him seriously. They see him as a character.
The buffoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And any character, people either love the character or hate the character. The difference with Weiner, I think, is that he was taken seriously. He was seen as like a serious... serious pillar of the progressive left. You know, he was the guy who was the scrappy political fighter, and that's a character a lot of people like. It's just the thing I keep coming back to is this could have been the guy who could have been the, you know, picture a world where he learned his lesson, where he stayed off Twitter, where he focused himself on like being a good husband and father and running for mayor of New York and all these other things. Imagine like in 2013 he wins the mayor. So he does two terms as mayor, comes out in like 2020 as a Democratic nominee for president. Imagine that election, Trump versus Weiner. That would have been powerful. And, you know, it might have provoked the Democrats into pulling up their own socks, because you see a lot of capitulation even in the face of a lot of what Trump is talking about. It's it's a terrible story of if only he had kept his phone out of his pants. it's some kind of drama. It's tragic in its own way that this is a man who undone by his own faults, and you know, I think we're only ever undone by our own faults, but I mean, there was just so much opportunity here.
Yeah, and I think that is the lesson from it, in that you can't just sort of, they used to call it resting on your laurels. You just,
yeah,
you're under this grand assumption that, okay, I've been this four-term, person elected that many times and started off as a young man, and still at that early, I guess he was in his early mid-40s when this was all going down.
Yeah,
that you know, there's still a lot of time there, whereas a lot of people reach their, you know, sort of get started or get into their peak in their 40s, whereas he's been around for a long time. I think he might have been one of the youngest elected. And then he just, you know, it went south completely. And now he's in, like, Sharknado 3. So there's lots of cameos in Sharknado 3, but he's one of them. So you go from this, you know, these heights to the depths. I guess Ann Coulter's in it, too, so I don't know if that's saying anything.
It's worth noting that the current president-elect has a cameo in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. So it's...
Yeah.
Those sorts of things don't...
So I guess that's a thing now as well. Yeah.
My second pick is a documentary. I believe it was from 2007, but it's called The Dixie Chicks, Shut Up and Sing. And it basically follows, I guess they had cameras rolling on the Dixie Chicks when in January, I think it was, no, March 2003, when Natalie Maines, who's the lead singer of the Dixie Chicks, said in front of a London audience that she was ashamed that the president of the United States was born in Texas. It was, of course, mere days before the war in Iraq launched. And the Dixie Chicks were pilloried, and they were really quite savaged for what was, in essence, an off-the-cuff remark, and Maine's sort of playing to the crowd. A lot of people forget London was home base for some of the biggest anti-war demonstrations, even though Tony Blair was Robin to George W. Bush's Batman in this scenario. But there was a million-person demonstration against the war. Again, days before the Dixie Chicks were at the Shepherd Bush playing their show. This was, of course, the nadir or the peak of their, it ended up being their nadir, but it was the peak of their appeal. They had the number one selling album. They were the biggest women group of all time. Any musical category, they ruled country radio. Literally weeks beforehand, they performed the national anthem at the Super Bowl, so you can't get more American than that. This kind of sank them, and they were getting death threats. So the root of the title, Shop and Sing, is there's an interview with a radio station DJ, and she says, you know, they should just shut up and sing, and that's where the title comes from. But it follows through that, like, very tense period, including when they get a death threat from somebody who says, who, like, with time and day, says that he will shoot Natalie Maines at this Dallas concert. And so there's this incredible sequence where they're like, where they go through, like, basically a security briefing of how they're going to get in and out of Dallas safely. And they actually get, you know, they get in costume and get made up in San Antonio. And then they all get on a plane, fly to Dallas, where they're taken directly from the airport to the venue with police escort for the Dixie Chicks. and people are being wanded and going through metal detectors going into their show, like Dixie Chicks fans, all these like middle-aged white people. And I mean, there's more than that, but I mean, it is interesting. And then it jumps ahead to 2006 when they're 2005, 2006, when they're putting together their a follow-up to the last album, and that was the Not Ready to Make Nice song came out of that. One of the things that kind of drew me to this who am I thinking of? Mark Twain said, you know, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes, and we're sort of seeing the same thing now with with Trump, where you're seeing certain people coming out against Trump, and not just like celebrities like the Dixie Chicks, but people like, you know, just regular people on the street, people on Twitter who will say things about Trump. And we saw this again this past week, the Vanity Fair restaurant review. And, you know, Trump responds or one of his supporters respond, and there's this kind of like locus effect where everybody piles on this one person. And that's exactly what happened with the Dixie Chicks, is that it just became the symbol for people looking to, you know, dump on someone who thinks differently. The difference being, of course, this was an issue that people were galvanized into a fervor of patriotism because the country was going to war in response to an attack. And yeah, we can make the point about Iraq not being behind 9/11, blah, 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 blah. But that was the feeling. The difference with Trumpism, though, is that people are defending the man who's taken like stances on different stances on every issue. He's been on every side of every issue. And that is so much more difficult to defeat because, yeah, eventually it gets to the point where we see this in the movie, you know, the fans do come back and, you know, the Dixie Chicks are still making music. One of the things that has bothered me to this day is, like, I don't think anyone's ever apologized, at least not in a public way, at least not in a public way that is equal to the public reaction to that. I don't think anyone's come out and said, you know what, they were right. You know what, we shouldn't have jump down their throats like that because this thing has turned to garbage. And it wasn't like it happened like a decade later. This was like 2 years later. It was like summer of 05 things started going south for the administration in terms of how they were prosecuting the war. But people like Michael Moore and Hans Blix, who took a bold stand, or Hans Blix, who was like actually, again, expert, who knows different, who knows of the situation, and came out and said, there's no weapons of mass destruction. Everyone's like, you're a traitor, blah, 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 blah. And I don't think Hans Blix has ever gotten an apology, or at least not like a full-throated public one from the very people who, you know, thought he was a traitor and apathetic and that, you know, he was against America. And that kind of bothers me about this, too, and in looking back at all this.
Well, and that is the problem with it, in that she just had an opinion, right? She stated something not even particularly that bad.
Yeah.
But I think the difference we see now in 2016 from, say, 2003 is that it was still that period where it took longer for something like this to percolate.
Yeah.
Now we're so accustomed to things just sort of being tweeted right away. Twitter wasn't even really a thing in 2003,
no.
Was it?
Twitter was 09.
Nor Facebook. So yeah. I wouldn't say it was the turning point, but things have evolved since then in that there is this, like, we're getting the barrage of this stuff daily, hourly, almost to the minute sometimes, whereas we were still at that point then where it took time for things to trickle out. I think back to the John Lennon comments in the 60s when there was that famous interview when he said the Beatles were bigger than Christ. And that took some time to snowball, but it was the visceral reaction was the same thing, the burning of records and boycotting of shows. And I think that was the point where the Beatles said, okay, we're not going to tour anymore. But it's still the same kind of thing. And, you know, why do we expect musicians in particular, and people get asked about all sorts of things. It's almost as if, you know, rather than just ask, so how's the album going? We get all these things where musicians are asked their political opinions. Now, mind you, she offered up the opinion.
Right.
It wasn't as if she just, but of course it was in the air, as you say about that, the million person march in London.
Yeah.
It was when something's in the air like that, you're going to comment on it. It wasn't as if it was a sit down interview.
No.
But you know, the result is the same. We have this explosion of, about Wiener too, I think a lot of it is to do with the timing of things, whereas that hit at the exact moment and people who supported the war and Bush were looking for somewhere to dump. And that's what's interesting about it too, in that the Dixie Chicks were within, you know, we consider the realm of country music to be a conservative realm.
Right.
You know, there aren't, when somebody is a, let's say, of not of the conservative bent, and I mean small c, not just Republicans, they tend to, they are a rebel within that group.
Right.
Whereas they almost seem surprised that somebody within their sphere could have how dare you have such an opinion, you're a traitor, and because that's the market, let's say, to country music in the States generally, not all of it, but the mainstream stuff is, you know, has that bent where, you know, you see the guy in the Stars and Stripes shirt singing the anthem. And
you have to remember how amped up it was, too.
Yeah, there's that, too. When things are tense.
And it shows, like, the whole comment because they if you've ever been to a concert, you know that there's sometimes a little chat between songs as, you know, the instruments are tuned to do the next number. And so she said, I don't remember the exact phrase. I didn't write it down, but she just said, you know, just so you guys know, we also like don't like all this talk about war and violence. And then she says, and we're ashamed that the president is from Texas. So it was like really, really off the cuff. But the way it was sort of phrased, in the way it was picked up in the coverage and in the press was that, like, this was like a highly calculated political statement, and it wasn't that at all.
Stage banter, really.
And yeah, and what I mean, what happened was this situation ended up politicizing the Dixie Chicks, not vice versa. And you know, there's a lot of great stuff in it where Natalie Maines, it's like being like super defined. Like, why do we have to like even go back to country? Because they're talking about the new album and like how they're going to market it, and she's like, who cares about like trying to make friends with these people again? And I get that impulse very much. The other side of it too was during country music at this time, you had people like Toby Keith talking, you know, making himself political by writing a song about shoving America's boot up the ass of its enemies. Yeah. That's almost exactly a song lyric. He put it a bit quote unquote poetically than I did. But, the other thing that really bothered me, and I had to watch the movie again to remember it. Some of the comments that were made by pundits, Bill O'Reilly in particular, said that they were the dumbest bimbos he had ever seen. Pat Buchanan said that they deserve to be slapped around, which is like misogyny. I mean, and it's
embedded. I mean,
yeah,
we see it a bit less now, but you know, it's still there. It still presents itself. It's convenient. Some of the things have been said about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah,
you know, it hasn't really changed that much in terms of that approach to the commentary.
Yeah, and it's directed at the fact that they are women, because you know Bruce Springsteen was against war. They probably I'd have to review all the footage.
Bruce is having a bad day.
Yeah. No one would have said Bruce Springsteen should be slapped around. No one would say that, and it was all about them being women and being anti-war. And again, the thing that still bothers me to this day is that no one's extended the hand to them and said, you know what, you are right, and we shouldn't have gone off the deep end like we did, because there was a party in the right and there was a party in the wrong, and you know the party in the right has kept going on, but the party in the wrong has kind of forgotten that they were wrong in the first place and are just, you know, leaving at that.
Well, we'll apologize. Sorry for your trouble, Dixie Chicks.
You know what? It turned me into a Dixie Chicks fan. I was like, I'll check out these ladies who are being, you know, having their CDs run over, and it turns out they're not bad. And I was never a huge country music fan, but I mean, I did like some of their songs, so they made me a fan.
So there you go. For the fans who lost, they've gained one.
They gained way one
up
back
here
in the Great White
here
North.
Here in Canada.
Anyway, for fans of the show, I'm afraid that's all for this week. And coming up next week, we will have our annual award show, so stay tuned for that. That is on favorite, I know, for you guys, and favorite for us as well. And then we'll be back live on January the 5th. You can stay connected to Open Sources all week long at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Open Sources Newswire on Facebook is where you can find us. @OS_Guelph is where you can find us on Twitter. And, of course, you can get past episodes of Open Sources Guelph, including this episode in a couple of days, on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through iTunes. You can connect with me on Twitter @AdamADonaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. I blog at a place called The Spanner Book. There should be something new there. I make promises that I can't keep. No, I'm
a Christmas blog.
I'm on holidays for a little bit. Yeah, it won't be about Christmas this time. My notorious Christmas blog has been effectively canceled. But no, there'll be something there to read. Spannerbook.wordpress.com.
And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, all through the holiday season. And in case we don't see you out and about, because we are out and about, have a Merry Christmas or a Happy Holidays, however you celebrate and whoever you celebrate it with. And be back here next week for more episodes of Open Sources. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll see you next week at 5.